Welcome back to the program. To be president is to be both anointed and at the same time scarred for life. To date, only 44 men have joined that club and fully understand what it means to be in that office. Never have more than 6 of them ever met at any one time, making it arguably the most exclusive club in the world. 2 of the finest reporters and writers for Time Magazine now take us inside that exclusive club, which includes its own very special clubhouse. We're joined today by Nancy Gibb. She's the deputy managing editor of Time Magazine, and Michael Duffy, who is a Time executive editor and chief of Time's Washington Bureau. He's appeared regularly on PBS's Washington Week for over 15 years. Together, they're the authors of the previous bestseller, The Preacher and the Presidents, Billy Graham and the White House. It is my pleasure to welcome Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy here today to talk about their newest book, The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Nancy Gibbs, Michael Duffy, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Great to have you here. One of the things that you talk about, Michael, start with you, is this sense that in each new presidency, that every president seems to come to office thinking that everything starts anew, that they don't need the benefit and the ideas of those that came before. They're going to sort of reinvent it. This time it's different. And that doesn't turn out to be the case.
No, it's a common mistake. They almost all tend to make it. It's part of our political system. You know, it's Americans want and believe in change, so most of them campaign for change. But when they get there, they oftentimes take their first look around and have their first intelligence briefing, and they go, whoa, maybe the guy who was here before didn't have it so wrong after all. And it's a common thread that is shot through all of this book, where when Kennedy takes over from Eisenhower, when Clinton takes over from Bush, to some extent, even when Obama takes over from Bush too. So all the way through the last 65 years, we see this pattern of being surprised by how much more complicated they find the job, how the only way they can really master it is on the job. There's no training for this. And how they all, after a year or so, have to rejigger in some way and recalibrate their assumptions for the realities of being commander-in-chief.
Is there ever, Nancy, an arc to this? Is it often driven by crisis or problems that arise, or is there some kind of arc that we see when they're willing to reach back?
Well, certainly the first time a new president finds his back up against a wall, that's a very commonly a time when they reach out. Now, if it's someone like Lyndon Johnson, who becomes president in an instant with Kennedy's assassination, he's on the phone with Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower that very night. And he tells Eisenhower, I've needed you for a long time. I need you more than ever now. And, you know, Ike's in his car the next day driving to the White House to see Johnson. With other presidents, it takes a little longer, as you suggested. You know, sometimes it's the first crisis. You know, with Kennedy, it was the Bay of Pigs when suddenly all of that, the qualities of the Eisenhower administration that he had rejected, of this very sort of militaristic decision-making structure, didn't look so bad to him now that he had seen how badly a decision can go wrong. So it varies from president to president, but all of them, sooner or later, and usually it's sooner, find themselves either facing some issue they want to discuss or some delicate overseas mission that only a former president can really help them out with.
The Kennedy-Eisenhower thing is interesting because after the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs, one is not sure right away whether Kennedy just wanted that photo op with Eisenhower or whether or not he was surprised that there was really something he got out of it.
And that's because I think it was both. I absolutely think the original motivation was to have that picture. Kennedy reached out to a lot of people. He called Richard Nixon a few days after the Bay of Pigs. He was reaching out in order to kind of, you know, build some solidarity in the country. You know, the entire world was criticizing the United States at that moment.
Which reminds me a little bit, in a very different context, Jeff, of how the first two people that Barack Obama called after he had finished the strike on Osama bin Laden last May, we're not to congressional allies or foreign leaders. He called President George W. Bush first, and then he called Bill Clinton, because both men had tried repeatedly to kill bin Laden, had been unable to do so, had been frustrated both by their own uncertainty, difficulties of intelligence, problems with the law. And I think he reached out in a different kind of continuity to those two men first, saying, mission accomplished. Not bragging, but saying it took all of us to do it.
Right, and that there's also the sense in that continuity that the office itself carries with it that sense of continuity and that sense of history, that sense that, Teddy White talked about, that so power passes. And they all seem to get that.
They all do, and they all, that's why they all come together in moments of crisis to protect the presidency. I don't want to make it seem like it's all kumbaya, though.
Right.
There are a number of times over the last 5 or 6 decades in this book where these men do not get along, and they fight quite dramatically, sometimes quite viciously. These are giant men with huge egos and very large senses of themselves, who believe, you know, once you're president, you never really stop being president. You still think you have the best ideas and the best approaches.
Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon being perhaps the penultimate example of where it didn't work out too well.
Well, you know, that's one of the most fascinating relationships. You have two of the most complex, often devious, skillful connivers ever to be in the White House. And in this case, when they started conniving and deceiving each other, you really get kind of an epic wrestling match between two presidents. And, you know, what we discovered was that the battle between those two took place across 5 years, 3 continents, through 2 elections, with each of them blackmailing the other. And so, you know, we watch these presidents using all the tools, you know, that have made them successful, all the tools that can often make for a successful president, but sometimes they're using them, you know, on one another.
Talk a little bit about the way they came together, I guess, in 1981, going to Sadat's funeral, this icy plane ride over, and a very different plane ride back.
I call that chapter Three Men in a Funeral, Jeff, because after Sadat is assassinated in Cairo, Ronald Reagan and George Bush, the vice president, can't really go. It's just too dangerous. And so a plan is hatched to send the three former presidents, Nixon, Ford, and Carter. These three did not get along. You know, Ford had replaced Nixon and then pardoned him. Carter had replaced Ford. There was just not a lot of love on the plane, and the plane had a cast of other characters that was unbelievable just going for the funeral. And on the way over, they put aside their differences slowly. There's a lot of confusion about who's sort of the lead player. And on the way back, Nixon drops off, and Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, both of whom had fought very badly in 1976, actually become friends on the plane. They start talking about how difficult it is to raise money for their libraries. They turn out to have a kind of mutual dislike of Ronald Reagan. The club has its alliances, and they essentially pledge on that flight back to help each other and to do things together and to launch projects together. And I think both of them were men who had been thrown out of office before they had expected to be, found across party some mutual interests, and also I think realized as one or less than one term presidents that they were probably going to be more powerful inside the club if they stuck together.
Is there a difference within the club in one term versus two term presidents?
There is. It's, you know, the ultimate, I think, vindication that they, you know, until history has a chance to weigh in, is, of course, whether the public gives you a second term. And so it's something they are certainly very conscious of. What is interesting is that, you know, you could look at President George Herbert Walker Bush right now as one of our most sort of revered elder statesmen, and yet he did not win his second term. Jimmy Carter, who also got thrown out of office after one term, has been widely acknowledged to be one of our most successful ex-presidents. He was the first to say that he was a better ex-president than he was a president. But it's certainly easier for them if they got to sort of complete their mission and have the vindication of re-election. But having said that, even the successful ones leave office with often even more of the scars that 8 years of governing leaves them with. And so in that sense have even more, an even deeper bond with the other men who've played the role.
Among this current crop of ex-presidents, it seems that Jimmy Carter is often the black sheep of the group.
Yeah, there's no question that two factors contribute to this. One is just Carter's been an ex-president longer than anyone else. You know, he left office in 1981. At that point, he was, I think, maybe 56, 57. In September, Jeff, he's going to become the longest living former president in American history. 31 years, 8 months, 23 days, surpassing Herbert Hoover. This required Carter essentially to start his life over and create a whole second career for himself. In fact, he's reinvented what it means to be a former president. That's the good news. The bad news is Carter sometimes also has has a my way or the highway approach to the many projects he's involved in, whether it's overseeing elections overseas or solving all kinds of health problems in Africa and Asia, to issues here at home, Middle East and arms control, in, most notably. Each president who has followed has called on Carter to do something, to go overseas, to run a tricky mission, to unravel some foreign problem, and they all recognize that he can open doors because of his vast humanitarian work overseas. On the other hand, it's hard for him to stay on script. And so, as Bill Clinton said, you know, Carter's a complicated partner, but it's usually worth it.
It's interesting that in many ways the Clinton model, the Clinton post-presidency model, is patterned in some respects after Carter.
Totally. I think Carter taught Clinton how to be a former president. I think you can hear in Clinton's comments about Carter when Clinton was still president that he's watching Carter and seeing what he's doing with the Carter Center in Atlanta and thinking to himself, I could do something like this. Now, the Clinton Global Initiative has turned out to be much bigger, mm-hmm. much broader, and probably will have, like the Carter Center, a 30- or 40-year run of effectiveness, maybe longer. I'm very interested to see whether Hillary Clinton moves into that role as she exits the Secretary of State at the end of this year, or whether she actually decides to run herself,
mm-hmm.
which could set up the possibility of course, potentially the first female member of the club.
Right.
Too early to say, of course.
Talk a little bit about one of the most fascinating relationships, and that is the relationship between Clinton when he was president and Richard Nixon.
Well, you know, this is what more unlikely pairing can you imagine than these two men of, you know, different parties, different generations, different parts of the country, you know, completely different dispositions. And when Clinton is elected, no president in American history other than Abraham Lincoln came into office with five former presidents still on stage. And one way or another, they all wanted to get the new guy's attention, but none of them more than Nixon. Nixon was, you know, calling and calling and calling, wanting to talk to Clinton. He wrote an op-ed talking about what a, you know, great opportunity this was, still didn't hear anything. He writes another op-ed that is, you know, much sharper in what lies ahead for Clinton, and he basically sends the message, look, he either takes my calls, or these op-eds are going to get really tough. And so they finally connect. And Clinton, you know, and Nixon become fairly quickly late-night phone buddies. And it isn't just that Clinton finds Nixon as an elder statesman, a very shrewd assessor of Russia and of China and of some of the foreign policy challenges Clinton's wrestling with. He asks him just about how to organize his day. How do you handle the office and the scarcity of time in the face of so many demands on it?
And at that point, the Clinton White House was kind of a mess.
It was a mess. And, you know, he was figuring out that actually organizing it right and, you know, allocating his time and his resources shrewdly was essential to being successful. And President Clinton told us that at one point, very shortly before Nixon died, he wrote Clinton a letter. It's never been released, but it's seven single-spaced pages. And Clinton found it so wise and so helpful. He cherishes it. He says he still, to this day, takes it out and rereads it every year.
There is a sense that truly that comes through that when Nixon died, that Clinton missed having him around. I mean,
oh, yeah.
And in his eulogy at the Nixon funeral,
he wanted to rehabilitate Nixon. This caused some consternation in the Clinton White House. Rehabilitate Richard Nixon? Are you crazy? But Clinton was so shrewd, he said, no, I'm going to cast Nixon in death as a moderate Republican, which in many ways he was, having started the EPA and trying to launch an early form of health care reform. And so he gave a eulogy in which he repositioned Nixon in the sort of great big middle of the Republican Party rather than then at the time, and of course now, where the conservative right wing of the party was ascendant, which is a shrewd piece of thing the club does to each other all the time. They're always, you know, especially in death, recasting each other as greater statesmen than perhaps they were, to serve the purposes of whoever is in office. And he gave the final line of the eulogy was, you know, may the days of judging Richard Nixon by one event come to an end.
I mean, the irony of trying to cast them as the moderate is that when one looks at what Nixon did in terms of the Southern strategy, it was in many ways the precursor to where the party has gotten to today.
Which is why I think Clinton's own aides had great misgivings about trying to do this to Nixon, but Nixon, of course, Clinton prevailed. It's a similar thing to what Barack Obama has done by paying such homage and respect to George Herbert Walker Bush, the father, who's now 87, while having not so much of a relationship with George Walker Bush, number two.
You talk about the fact, Nancy, that Obama really worked George Herbert Walker Bush from the very beginning.
He did. He made it very clear upon taking office that he wanted to reach out to the first President Bush, pay him a visit. He ended up going down to Bush's presidential library and honoring him in a tribute to his life in public service. And I think it is very similar, as Michael suggested, about Clinton and Nixon, in that Obama was realized, apart from whatever personal reasons he had for wanting to get to know the first President Bush, that he was exalting a kind of Republican that we were not seeing so much anymore. You know, in comparison to the current Republican Party, the first President Bush is much more moderate, and it didn't do Obama any harm to be associated with that brand as he was trying to build this new post-partisan age.
How much of the reaching back towards Bush 41 on the part of Clinton, and we can talk about Clinton's relationship with Bush 41 and Obama reaching back, is this attempt to sort of cross generational lines, to reach back to sort of the last presidential link to the greatest generation?
I tend to think it's that's obviously an advantage. And in many ways, George Herbert Walker Bush is the president of the club at the moment. He's the oldest of the five. He is the one who has really set the tone, not only for his own son, but for Clinton. There's a great paternity inside the fraternity. but I think most of the wooing of Bush 41 is by Clinton. It's an attempt to learn, again, how to be an ex-president, because Bush sets such a standard. I think in Obama's case, it's an attempt, as with Clinton and Nixon, to point out that there was or is or may still yet be a brand of Republicanism that is more sensible from his point of view. It's a tiny piece of political positioning.
But we do also, as Michael suggested, think it's one of those fascinating twists of history that you have for George Herbert Walker Bush. One of his actual sons becomes president, and on either side are two men who never knew their own fathers, and particularly in the case of President Clinton, to whom President Bush became a father figure. Barbara herself said, you know, I think he's the father that Clinton never had. And so the Bush clan has now bestowed on Bill Clinton a nickname, which, as you know, in that family means something. They call him their brother from another mother.
Talk a little bit about how you envision, and it's still early, certainly, Bush 2 fitting into this and sort of going with some of these models we've been talking about.
It's a great question. I think, Jeff, it's still a work in progress. After having the club together to meet Barack Obama in January of 2009 at the White House for lunch, he then, you know, he goes with Obama to the swearing-in on the 20th. He gives him a little bit of advice in the car about pardon policy, and then he walks off the stage. He exits the grid, just disappears for essentially for 3 years, saying nothing except that Obama deserves my silence. Very classy, obviously very different from his own vice president. Which is a reminder of how different it is to be president. These men do understand that there's something about that job that gets you a level of immunity that even being vice president doesn't obviously convey. And even, I think about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, Bush made some of his only remarks about Obama's handling of the job, very gently constructive comments about tax policy and energy policy. I don't even think you could call it criticism. But he did say at the end of those remarks, Jeff, that I don't think, quote, our country should be criticizing our president. So he's been very, very careful. I'm guessing that he has, like all of them, come out with his own sets of scars and things he has to work through personally. He's been spending a lot of time working with injured veterans. It's very quiet, particularly using bicycles and mountain biking to return to a sense of normalcy for men who had been in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's not flashy. I suspect that the most important relationship in the club right now is actually the one between Clinton and George Walker Bush. Mm-hmm. They're both 66. They're the two men, presidents both born most closely together in American history. They're just 6 weeks apart. They represent two completely different ends of the baby boom generation culturally. They both are quite crazy about Bush 1. And so How those two men go forward, I think, really will determine the sort of direction of the President's Club for the next generation, because they have the greatest potential to cross lines and do good, just as they did in Haiti.
I want to touch on something you said, Michael, and not to go too far towards armchair psychoanalysis here, but there is a decompression period. There is a period of time that all these guys seem to go through once they're out of the office before they really do get their sea legs.
Carter told us he got depressed for a year. He really had to wrestle with the meaning of being defeated. He had to, and figuring out what he was going to do with the rest of his life. He said it took him a couple of years just to sort of regain his balance.
And even the ones who aren't, you know, depressed by losing, I mean, Eisenhower left office every bit as honored as he entered office, and yet, you know, he talked about watching the inaugural platform being constructed outside the White House and saying, you know, he felt like he was the guy watching his scaffold being built. You know, the idea of having been in that position, as draining and daunting as it can be, is also, it's hard to walk away from. And these tend to be obviously very ambitious type A personalities, and going to a next phase of life that no one can quite predict how that is going to go. It's a very complicated transition.
I was once talking to Bush 41 a couple of summers ago, and we were talking about Billy Graham, who at this point had passed 90, and Billy in his heyday was hard-charging evangelist. And I stupidly, and he's a very good friend of Bush's, and I foolishly said to Bush 41, you know, it's not easy going, you know, being a AAA personality in your 89th year, and he let a beat go by, and he said, "Tell me about it," which was very funny.
We haven't talked much about Reagan. Talk a little bit about Reagan. Obviously, came to his post-presidency at a much later point in life, but the story about him teaching Bill Clinton to salute is pretty good.
Yeah, it's a great story. It happened in L.A., right here in L.A. In fact, I'm looking at the building where it happened. Clinton's elected in 1992. He's out in L.A. before being sworn in during his transition. He pays a courtesy call on Reagan at Century City. They go upstairs to Reagan's, you know, 55th floor, you know, office, and they're talking about nothing in particular. And finally, Clinton says, "Do you have any advice for me?" And Reagan says, "Yeah, you got to use Camp David, because that's just a great place to go and get away from the White House. And the other thing you got to do is you got to learn how to salute. I've been watching you on the campaigns. You don't know how to do it. It's pathetic and wimpy. We can't have a president with a wimpy salute." So he teaches Clinton there in his office to, you know, bring it up slowly and bring it down sharply. And so literally the two men are standing in Reagan's office practicing how to salute, which is part of another tradition of the club, which is they pass along things. You know, Ike showed Kennedy how to, you know, bring the helicopter to the backyard really fast if you have to make a getaway. Johnson showed Nixon where they kept the tape machine, the tape recorder. And in this case, Reagan showed Clinton how to salute. It's just another feature of membership.
Nancy, what was the Nixon-Reagan relationship like?
Fascinating. I mean, these two men met in 1947 in Southern California. They were rivals for the GOP nomination by 1967. And we have some letters back and forth between them in that period that I don't think have ever been published before that are fascinating about their little dance of the veils. Both men running, neither man admitting it. When Nixon becomes president, he sort of tries to keep, you know, Reagan happy and mollified, but he doesn't think much of him. That's clear from the White House tapes. By the time Reagan becomes president, Reagan is quite keen to have all the advice he can get until Nixon just becomes too much trouble, too many handfuls, has too many ideas. But I think Reagan, in many ways, rehabilitated Nixon after Watergate, brought him back, and quietly gave him things to do, and really restored his membership rights in the club more than, obviously, Carter or Ford had.
What was the role of the club in both Nixon's travails and his ultimate resignation and in the Clinton impeachment?
Well, we were fascinated with, because of the 1968 campaign, so remember, Lyndon Johnson has decided not to run for another term. All he really wants is to leave office as a peacemaker. And Nixon, of course, all he really wants is to win that election. And so in the final days of that election, the Johnson White House discovers, through all sorts of very sensitive intelligence gathering, that Nixon's people have been quietly sabotaging the Vietnam peace talks because they're afraid, of course, if there's a big breakthrough, that'll lose Nixon the election, Humphrey will be elected. And so so Johnson discovers this and has a very difficult decision to make about whether to reveal it, and ultimately decides for a number of reasons not to, not least 1968 being such a traumatic year for the country. I think having a sitting president accusing a major party candidate of what Johnson privately referred to as treason might just have been more than the system could bear. But one thing that that meant is that Nixon was very intent on keeping Johnson happy because he knew Johnson knew a lot of his secrets. And even more interesting, there's a memo that has only recently been declassified that Johnson's national security advisor wrote that suggests that because basically Nixon's team got away with what they got away with in 1968, that it emboldened them to do whatever it takes, and that in some ways the seeds of Watergate lay not in Nixon's, you know, desperation to get reelected, he won in a landslide in 1972, but in the back and forth between him and Johnson, the secrets they were hiding from each other. And that's a very interesting way to think about Watergate, and it made us look very differently at the events that ultimately brought Nixon down. The other thing that fascinated us is that Harry Truman died at Christmas time in 1972, and Lyndon Johnson died about 6 weeks later, 2 days after Nixon's second inauguration, which means in Nixon's second term, and by the time Watergate is consuming his presidency, there is no club. There are no other presidents alive at that time.
Ford played a role, though, in Clinton's impeachment.
Yeah, there's no question that Ford, having pardoned Nixon in 1974, but being unable to really exact from Nixon the kind of apology that he'd hoped for. Nixon was just too wily a negotiator. By the time Clinton is facing impeachment, Ford takes it upon himself in 1998 to try to hotwire a non-impeachment solution to get Clinton censured. He thought, okay, this is bad for my party to be impeaching a president. It's bad for the country. And most important, I think Ford believed, it was bad for the presidency, not for Clinton. The club cares more about the office and the powers of the presidency than it does about any one person in it. So first, Gerald Ford writes an op-ed in the late summer of 1998. And a few weeks later, he's joined by Carter, and they do a second one, essentially trying to execute a backdoor way out of this crisis, constitutional crisis. And so in what's great about what we found in the book and the President's Club is so, you know, full of these kinds of stories is, you know, behind the scenes, secretly, Ford and Clinton are in negotiations to try to, you know, avoid impeachment. And Ford has his own set of ideas about how to get this done. Clinton is keen for a while to look for a way out. But as time goes by and we head into Christmas and New Year's, it's clear that Clinton really wants a showdown with the Republicans. He thinks it's helping him politically. But Ford would be there. Again, now he's in his 89th or 88th year trying to execute pull off some kind of solution to the crisis. Now, Clinton decides that he wants to actually fight it out, that it would be good politics to simply have the fight and win.
One of the things that you point out is that oftentimes presidents of different parties get along better in their post-presidencies.
We were very struck by this, and it starts with, you know, the book really begins with the most unlikely of all imaginable pairings of Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover, two men, not just different parties, you know, different planets. And yet they became, through working together on missions they thought, you know, much more important than any political differences between them, they became such good friends that Hoover ultimately wrote Truman a letter about how much he had come to cherish their relationship. Truman framed it and kept it on his desk until the day he died. We saw this with Johnson and Eisenhower. We saw this, as we've talked about, Clinton and Nixon. You know, all through the book, we kept being surprised by what we were learning. You know, we have written about many of these presidents as journalists for, you know, the last 20 years, and yet when we found that instead of looking at them as individuals, when we looked at them in combination, in partnerships and trios and quartets, they suddenly looked very different to us. And often the rivalries and the tensions between presidents from the same party were more pronounced than those from different parties.
And before I let you go, tell us about the clubhouse. There really is a clubhouse for this club.
There really is, and one of the great discoveries inside the book, The President's Club, is that there is a special place Richard Nixon created for Lyndon Johnson in 1969 on Lafayette Square. It's an unmarked brownstone building. I'm pretty sure I was the first reporter to get into it about 2 weeks ago. It's a very nice place. It wasn't always, but they fixed it up. It's for the exclusive use of former presidents, either as a place to work or a place to stay overnight. And I think probably a half dozen presidents have stayed there, and it's a pretty nice perk of the office even after you've left it. I think George Herbert Walker Bush used it the most. My favorite detail is that the beds are embossed with the seal of the president, so that when you wake up in the morning, if you're not exactly sure what job you held 15 or 20 years ago, you can look down toward your feet and it'll tell you.
And didn't Jimmy Carter tell Richard Nixon he couldn't stay there once?
He did, yeah.
And because he...
I just think at some point Nixon's membership privileges were still revoked there in the late 70s. He would get them back. Ben Carter can be a cuss, so, you know, it's hard to know which was really operative. But it's just one of the many stories that we were able to uncover for this book over the last 5 years. And let me just say that, you know, it's an excellent Father's or Mother's Day gift, Jeff. So I know you're thinking this right now.
Absolutely. Nancy Gibbs, Michael Duffy. The book is The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Nancy, Michael, thank you so much.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks, Jeff.